Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out and a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight.
All right. Nick DiGilio here on the Voice of Chicago 720 WGN, live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Here for our full Friday night show. We're on from midnight till 5 a.m. every Friday night into Saturday morning. And then Saturday, our weekend shows are 6 p.m. to midnight. But actually, when we come in Saturday night, it'll be after the Cub game, so we're 7 to midnight on our Saturday show. Plus, by the way, all of next week I'm filling in for Bill Leff on the overnights. So make sure you stay tuned for that. All the updates are at WGNradio.com. You can also check us out at Facebook.com/Nick D Show. We're here till 5 a.m. Coming up a little bit later on, Richard Larmer is going to join us, our PR guru, who always has an interesting take on what's going on in the world of showbiz and pop culture. We'll talk to him after 2 o'clock, plus all of our regular features, including Drunks in the News, brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn, Straight Out of Context, and Nick D Show Spies, and we'll explain how you can be a part of all of those segments as well. All that and more is coming up, and Craig... is now, Craig, explain how what's going on, how easy it's going to be now for people to subscribe to our podcasts via iTunes. They have to go through iTunes, but it's going to begin to get easier for people to navigate and get and subscribe to the podcast. The full-length podcast, by the way, when we're done with the show, the entire show is available via podcast. So we're making it easier for everybody?
Yeah. So first and foremost, we need to make sure that everyone's aware that right now the best way, the absolute best way to download the podcast is to simply subscribe at iTunes. If you subscribe, your computer will automatically download all the new podcasts as soon as you open your iTunes on your computer. It works on your phone. It works on an iPod, pretty much anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And very soon, there actually will be a little button available on our website, on your show page, and on Facebook, hopefully, that just you can click to subscribe your computer directly there or to do it on your phone, too.
You do it one time, and you're automatically subscribed, and every full-length podcast will be downloaded into your computer or your phone or your iPad.
Every time your phone connects to the internet or your computer connects to the internet and you open up iTunes, the newest podcasts are there. They're available to listen to. It's that easy.
Okay. We're putting a link up on our Facebook page. I think you put one up a little bit earlier on our Facebook page. If you want to check it out and subscribe to our podcast, very, very easy to do. You have to do it through iTunes. It's the easiest way, the most convenient way. You click, you subscribe once, and then all of the podcasts come your way, and you can listen to them at your leisure, bro. So we have a link right on our Facebook page right now, and it's Facebook.com/Nick D Show, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. And I want to thank everybody. We are well past 8,700 fans on our Facebook page right now, the most of any show on WGN, which is kind of amazing. So we thank you for all your support and all that cool stuff, and continue to do so, Facebook.com/Nick D Show. You can send your texts throughout the night. We'll be checking texts. We're keeping you company till 5 a.m. Send your text to 24720, or you can call us at 312-981-7200. All right, every Friday night at midnight, we kick off the show with the Midnight Movie Reviews, and this week is no different. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com will review all the movies coming up that are available in your movie theaters and available on demand, where all you have to do is sit on your couch and press a button and watch a brand new movie. We'll tell you all about those as well. Again, if you have a movie comment or question, it's 312-981-7200.
Some that you recognize. Some
the familiar themes that we play during the Midnight Movie Review segment. Every Friday night, we help you plan your weekend. Colin Suter, Eric Childress, eFilmCritic.com. All three of us are members of the Chicago Film Critic Association, and we have been film critics. I've been a film critic for 28 years, and these guys have been doing it for many, many years as well. And we help you out trying to pick the movies that you want to see. We got the new ones coming into the theaters and the new ones available on demand. We review them every week. If you'd like to join us again, it's 312-981-7200. Colin, how are you?
Good. How are you,
I'm okay. Sir? And here's Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
All right. Before we get started on the new ones, I caught up on a couple of movies on demand that I wanted to mention. You guys reviewed David Gordon Green's new film, Prince Avalanche, last week with Emile Hirsch and Paul Rudd. I caught up with it, and I think it's pretty terrific. And I agree with pretty much 100% what you guys said. It's not quite up to the greatness of like his first four films, David Gordon Green, but it's definitely a return to form, with really wonderful performances, and there's a lot of funny stuff in this movie, and it's got a lot of the quirks and a lot of the stuff that we love about David Gordon Green in it, and it's so nice to see him back in that element after, you know, taking that detour, you know.
I watched it again. I watched it a second time, liked it even more.
Yeah. So. It's very, very good. So, and it's, by the way, it's in theaters this weekend as well, right? I mean, I think
it's only at the Music Box.
It's at the Music Box. Okay. It's David Gordon Green's new movie. What, Colin, really quickly, go over the plot again very quickly. all three of us recommend it, though. Eric, Colin, and I highly recommend Prince Avalanche, playing at the Music Box, also available on demand. And Colin, very quickly, give a synopsis.
Yeah, so it's Paul Rudd and Emil Hirsch, who played two guys in 1988, whose job it is to repair this long road in Texas that was that's in the middle of this area that's been just destroyed by wildfires, and homes are destroyed and everything. And most of the movie just centers on these two guys. I mean, they go off on the weekends and have little exploits and then come back, but we don't follow them on there. We just kind of focus on them here, working on this road together, sometimes getting along, sometimes not. Mostly talking about women. Paul Rudd's character is dating Emil Hirsch's sister, and there's some friction there. And occasionally they meet some, you know, people on the road who are driving by, or who, you know, one woman has a house that burned down and she's just kind of wandering around the house, or wandering around the remains, I should say. And, you know, it's a strange kind of, you know, it's almost kind of a coming of age movie. But it's just basically how these two characters relate to each other and how they kind of, you know, grow from working with each other. It's kind of goofy in spots and also very lyrical and poetic in other spots. And I think it fits in well with those first four films. I mean, there's little elements of George Washington in it. There's elements of Undertow, elements of All the Real Girls. I think it's practically a companion piece to that. I think a really, really terrific film.
Yeah, I'm with you. And Eric, you liked it very much as well, right?
Yeah, I very much enjoyed it.
Okay, cool. All right, Prince Avalanche is available on demand, which is how I saw it, and it's also at the Music Box this week. Okay. Now, the other one that I caught up with on demand is without question the most disappointing movie of the year for me. And you all know, if you are a regular listener to this show, and Colin and Eric have known me for years, I am perhaps the biggest Brian De Palma fan on the planet. I love all of his movies. His last movie, Redacted, I think is great. I love Black Dahlia. I love Femme Fatale, you know, and all the stuff that, like, he's really known for, you know, like Body Double and Scarface, Blowout, Dressed to Kill. All those movies I really love. Untouchables. His latest movie is Colin, have you seen this yet?
I have not.
Okay. His latest movie is a film called Passion, and it's a remake of, what's the title of the original film, Eric?
Love Crime.
Love Crime. All right, it's a remake of Love Crime, and it's his latest film. It's his first movie in five years, maybe.
Redacted was 2007, I believe.
Jeez. Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
6 years. His first movie in 6 years, and I don't even know.
It's hard, Nick. I know. We'll talk you through it.
You know, it's, you know, when a guy that you love so much, you know, look, I think Wise Guys is a damn good movie. So that's how much, and I like, you know what? I defend Bonfire of the Vanities as well. This is how much I like Brian De Palma. This movie, I think, is indefensible. It is everything that you said, Eric, is absolutely true. It is a guy who is, this is the laziest film I've seen all year. He's ripping himself off, but in a way with no creativity. Let me just say this, Colin, when you see the movie, or if you see it, and I don't recommend you do because it's pretty awful, but the first three scenes of the film, like the opening 6 or 7 minutes of the film, Eric, are you aware of Pino Donaggio's score, what it sounds like?
I haven't seen it since September, so okay. You have to remind me.
It's Magnolia. It's the score for Magnolia. He tweaks about 3 or 4 different notes, but you know that.
Okay.
It's the score for Magnolia, the middle section of Magnolia where, you know,
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, like the middle section of Magnolia. It's the whole sequence where it starts to rain and Bowen is driving his kid to the TV station and they're cutting back and forth between Tom Cruise at the seminar and all that. You know that whole sequence.
Oh yeah.
All right, and that score that carries it along, John Bryan's really brilliant suite, completely ripped off by DiNaggio. Now I know that he's done that 8 million times in other movies. Rips off Bernard Herrmann. I know that. Okay, but for some reason I got really pissed in the first 5 minutes of the movie. I'm like, what are you doing, man? That's John Bryan's score, and then he rips off his own scores from like Dressed to Kill, and it's. This is a carbon copy of a carbon copy of a carbon copy of Rich Little doing a Brian De Palma movie. I can't tell you how angry I was by the end of this movie. In the ending, I just wanted to put my foot through the TV at the end of the movie.
The last 10 minutes are maddening.
It's just
absolutely maddening.
It's like, okay, now I'm going to do Dressed to Kill.
Yep.
And I'm going to all the way till the final shot. I was like, this is a joke, right? I mean, it's by far the worst movie that Brian De Palma has ever directed by leaps and bounds. And if anybody sees this movie as sort of an introduction to Brian De Palma, you are doing yourself a disservice. So it made me very angry. It's hard, you know, it's hard for me to even talk about it because I love Brian De Palma's movies so much. But it's everything that you said, Eric. I agree with you 100%. I didn't think I'd ever agree with you 100% on a Brian De Palma movie.
Me neither.
But I do. As a fan, I was like so disappointing, so disappointing. And I don't know, man. Are there defenders out there? Because the only other guy that likes De Palma as much as I do, who is in our colleague circle, is Peter.
Yeah, he's defending it.
He's defending this movie.
Yep.
We need to have a talk, man.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have a talk. Wow. All right. Okay. Well, anyway, there you go. I got to see one really good movie on demand this week, and then one of the most disappointing movies of my life. So all right.
It's basically De Palma's Your Highness, is what I'm hearing.
It is, except that he's trying. You know, but see, whereas like Your Highness,
your level of disappointment.
Yes.
I mean,
okay. Because I was going to say,
I'm hearing
Your Highness is David Gordon Green doing something completely different, whereas Brian De Palma is kind of doing what he usually does, but not really.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And anybody who complains about stuff like Raising Kane and Femme Fatale, you know, at least he was doing something new there. Like Femme Fatale, he uses the same techniques, you know, that he's done 8 million times, but I think for, you know, very creative and original results. Same thing with Raising Kane, which is such a loony movie. You know, he uses all of those techniques, but he creates something new with it. There's not one new frame of film in this movie at all. All right, I'm going to stop because my blood pressure is going to go through the roof. All right, we have on-demand movies to talk about, and we'll jump into those coming up next right here on WGN. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN. We are doing the Midnight Movie Reviews. Colin Suter and Eric Childress from eFilmCritic.com join me. We talk about all the movies available in the theaters, the new ones, and the stuff that's on demand, where you just order it on your TV. Some of these movies aren't even in theaters yet. Some are in theaters and on demand. Some of these great new ways to watch all the new movies, and we cover them all for you. All right, Colin, Eric, welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Let's cover these on-demand movies. The first one that we're going to cover, Eric, is And While We Were Here. Tell us about that one.
Yes. This is a film starring Kate Bosworth as one half of an American couple on vacation. And she's a writer kind of struggling to sort of write this book of hers. The marriage that she's in, unfortunately, is rather loveless and just passionless, if you will. And she's listening to tapes from her grandmother, giving her sort of stuff about her experiences through the war and her own sort of loves and romances and whatnot. And that voice that we hear is played by Claire Bloom. And while on vacation, while this loveless marriage is going on, she meets a 19-year-old boy who sort of becomes the spark in her loins, if you will. This is a film that, you know, in many ways, it's kind of part Lost in Translation, part Take This Waltz, and kind of has all the passion of sort of a, you know, sort of a copycat of Godard or Truffaut even. It has a very sort of low-key, sort of French New Wave kind of feel about it. And when I say it has all the passion of those types of copycats, I'm, of course, referring to Brian De Palma's passion. Because this is a pretty horrible film, absolutely horrible film. It has none of the passion, actually, of any of those types of works, and especially Lost in Translation. And it really tries to fancy itself as being sort of a kind of a Take This Waltz, you know, this version of this woman that in this marriage that, you know, is just not there, and then is sparked by some newbie lover who's really just sort of, you know, almost like a stalker to her while she's on vacation. This movie's only 80 minutes long, and I wanted to, you know, just jump into a lake watching it.
Wow. Okay. That you didn't like it.
I did not.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. That is, and while we were here, and is it in black and white?
It is not.
Oh, okay.
No, it's in glorious Chanel color.
Okay. All right. This next one, I saw the trailer for this,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, you know, could you rip off Inception anymore?
The answer is no.
Okay. It's this is a movie called Extracted, which, by the way, is a term taken straight from Inception because they're doing extractions at the beginning of the movie, and the challenge is to do the Inception. So basically what, this movie's about the easier part?
Probably.
All right.
This is a film that premiered at South by Southwest in 2012. At least I think it did. That's how, you know, maybe my Inception is off a little bit.
Yeah.
And I had to go back to IMDb to remember precisely what this was about. All I remembered about it was exactly what you said, that it was a pretty bad ripoff of Inception.
Yeah.
And here's the plot, IMDb style. It's a scientist has invented a technique to watch people's memories. He finds himself in a dangerous situation after he's tasked with entering a heroin addict's mind to see whether the man committed murder.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's this sci-fi film about people entering other people's minds,
well,
and it's a,
know,
murder mystery.
It's not dreams, though. It's memories.
Right, exactly. So it's not quite, you know, Inception, and it's low budget, so we don't quite have Inception's budget. So please forgive us for, you know, not really having any of the ideas, because we really can't film them because we have no money. But that doesn't mean you have to do a bad movie, which is what this was. That's what I saw back in South by Southwest, and that's all I remember about it, is that I walked out going, like, that was just such a waste of my time.
Well, when I saw the trailer, I go, you got to be kidding me, right? I mean, it's not like Inception was a little movie. It was a bomb that nobody really saw.
Right.
And you can kind of rip it off, but you know, a few people saw Inception. That it kind of reminds me of that. What was that? What the hell was that Aaron Eckhart movie where they combined Taken and the one where he lost his memory? What the hell? What was
it? Oh, geez.
The Liam Neeson movie. Where
Unknown?
Unknown, right. So they took Taken and Unknown, they smashed them together, and they made that Aaron Eckhart movie that came out earlier this year.
It was an Aaron Eckhart movie?
Yeah, it was Aaron Eckhart. It was something with Aaron. I can't remember. I think it was a one-word title, too. It was an absolute complete, the trailer at least, I didn't see the movie, but the trailer at least was, as soon as it was over, I was like, well, you took Taken and Unknown, you put them together, and you threw Aaron Eckhart in the Liam Neeson role.
Is that the one, was he like protecting his daughter or something?
Yeah,
or?
I think so.
Oh, I know the one you're talking about, too, and I can't remember the title.
Hold on.
I can't remember the one word.
I'm going to the Erased.
Erased.
Erased, yeah. Even the title is.
Oh, yeah.
Are you kidding me, man? I mean, what wool are you trying to pull over? Wow. All right. Extracted. Exactly what I thought it was by watching the trailer, a complete ripoff of Inception. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, you guys, hang on. We got one more on-demand movie, and then we will go to the movie theaters to talk about the new stuff. Anytime you want to jump in for the Midnight Movie Reviews, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And coming up a little bit later on, Drunks in the News, sponsored by the greatest radio station. That's WGN. The greatest restaurant on the planet. The Gale Street Inn, plus Straight Out of Context, Nick D Show Spies, PR guru Richard Larmer is going to join us, and we're going to talk a bunch of other really cool stuff, keeping you company till 5 a.m. right here on WGN. The news is next, and then more movie reviews. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN. Midnight movie reviews continue. Coming up a little bit later on, Drunks in the News, sponsored by the greatest restaurant on the planet, The Gale Street Inn. Go in, say hi to George, tell him I sent you, have a great meal. We'll talk a little bit more about that a little later on. Straight Out of Context, Nick D Show Spies, and much more. Richard Larmer, our PR expert, is going to join us to talk pop culture, and we got lots of fun topics to take you through the night till 5 a.m. Eric and Colin are with me. We're doing the Midnight Movie Reviews. The phone number is 312-981-7200. Colin and Eric.
Hello.
Welcome back. You guys missed a really fun flashback convention. It was terrific. It really was terrific. And next week we are going to be reviewing this movie called You're Next, which they screened at Flashback. I know, Eric, you've seen it. Colin, have you?
Not yet.
Oh man. I'm not gonna, we won't review it fully, but let me just tell you this, it's gonna be on my top 10 list at the end of the year. That's all I'm saying. it kicks ass. Eric, you really undersold it, I think.
Yeah, a little, maybe.
Oh, maybe. Man. One of the best horror movies I've seen in a long time. And I'm telling you, 2013, right on, baby. Horror, I mean, I'm telling you. But let me just give you the highlight, okay? It was really, really great. Lots of very, very cool people. I did a bunch of fun Q&As. And, of course, you know, George Romero was there. And he keeps getting smaller and his glasses keep getting bigger. is basically what's happening. It's really true. So I got to do the Q&A with him, and we were taking questions from the audience. This was, for me, the funniest thing that was said all weekend was this. Somebody, of course, asked him, you know, one of the people asked him, as they always do, and rightfully so, what does he think of all the popularity of zombies now, you know, and all that stuff. And he's kind of sick of it. He's done, you know, he's done, man. He's like, I'm really, he said he liked the first season of Walking Dead. Now he's sick of it, you know. And he's kind of had it. He's, you know, he's like, everywhere I turn around, there's zombies everywhere, you know. And he talked about how he doesn't understand zombie walks, you know. So it was really awesome. And just, I'm obviously not doing it as well as hearing Romero say this. But my favorite moment was this: somebody had mentioned the zombie thing, and he goes, yeah, you know, and again, I don't want to go into the whole fast zombie thing. He goes, and then I see World War Z. Romero says, I see World War Z, and they're like insects, and they're climbing on top of each other, and it's like, oh, God. And so then I interject with, yeah, I wanted to blow my brains out during World War Z. And we're about to go to the next question, and then Romero kind of taps me on the shoulder, and he goes, yeah, so did I. And then there was kind of a pause, and then he goes, but then 2 weeks later, I saw Man of Steel, and I thought World War Z wasn't that bad. I was like, all right, and the whole place went nuts, you know. one of the highlights of the weekend, and he's still the man. Romero is just still the man. And there's a picture of me and him on our Facebook page. There's a picture of me and him, and me and Betsy Russell, who is fine, man. But I look happier while with my arm around Romero. I don't know what that says about me, but there you go. So anyway, the Flashback convention it was great, and we'll have another one next year. And I'm going to talk to you guys a little bit later on tonight and tomorrow about how you can save the Midway Drive-In. There's a way that you can save the Midway Drive-In, which Mike and Mia, who run the Flashback convention, own. And because of the switch to digital, it costs thousands and thousands of dollars to do that. And there is a way that we can help them save the Midway Drive-In. I'll tell you how to do that a little bit later on. Okay, speaking of zombies, again, the last film on demand. There's like two zombie movies a week now popping up on demand. And this one, cleverly enough, is called Harold's Going Stiff.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. All right. Yeah. Can you tell me? And I'm looking at the running time. It's 76 minutes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, there's a new problem in the United Kingdom known as ORD, or onset Richter's disease. And it's basically a three-stage approach to essentially becoming a zombie.
Uh-huh.
First, your body gets all stiff, and then you get a little more agitated, and then all of a sudden you want to start chewing on flesh. This one is definitely not your typical zombie film in the zombie tradition that you've just mentioned with all the Romero films and whatnot. This one is a little more of a comedy. It's done in kind of a mockumentary style, though not really sort of heavy-handed on the found footage stuff. It plays things, you know, relatively straightforward. And the main story is this guy, this elderly guy named Harold, who is actually the first person to develop this particular disease, and he's sort of managed to stay the longest without retreating to the final stage. And one of the reasons for that is his nurse in the film, who is very loyal, very helpful, trying to get him through this disease. And they develop a nice friendship that eventually sort of turns into a bit of a romance. And surprisingly enough, that's what kind of this film basically kind of becomes. It becomes this sort of romance, not done in a comedic way, but done as sort of these two sort of lonely souls who sort of find each other and sort of headed towards impending tragedy. I mean, this is a film that actually kind of makes a nice companion piece to warm bodies on sort of the opposite spectrum, you know, as opposed to, you know, someone being a zombie and falling in love. This is someone on the path to becoming a zombie and falling in love. This film is actually probably a lot more, probably less Night of the Living Dead and more like a Moor, actually. But still, comedy. There's this very funny stuff, particularly where they discover the disease may have actually come from. There's a very funny middle section about that. But the film is ultimately very melancholy and ultimately kind of moving. This is a kind of a lovely little surprise, and it's 77 minutes. It's just about the right length.
Yeah,
I think this is a film that I think also not just a companion piece to Warm Bodies, but also to a movie like Bubba Hotep, because it's a film that sort of deals with sort of the abandonment of the elderly, and there's stuff with assisted living in it that's kind of heartbreaking. This is a film I quite recommend.
Wow, that's great. That's a nice surprise.
Yeah.
Harold's Going Stiff, which is available on demand right now. All right, let's move it to the movie theaters. Colin, why don't you tell us about The Act of Killing?
Okay. This is playing at the Music Box, and it's a documentary by a guy named Joshua Oppenheimer, who works in Indonesia, and happened upon these guys who were at one time big-time murderers and gangsters back in the mid-60s. When there were mass killings of citizens who were thought to be communists. I mean, these guys were responsible for thousands, perhaps millions, of deaths of people who were dragged out of their homes, tortured, and killed. And now these guys are living fairly comfortably in Indonesia, and Oppenheimer offered them the chance to reenact their killings in the style of American genre films, of which these guys were huge fans. And it's not entirely clear what Oppenheimer thought would happen. I mean, who really could make an honest guess? But the events that ensue during the making of this film within a film, range from just, like, laughably absurd to shocking to, you know, moments of smacking yourself in the forehead and saying, oh, my God, did that guy really just say that? But the overall theme of the movie is disconnect. I mean, these guys who killed millions of people while watching American genre movies and, you know, now they're openly talking about their war crimes and trying to justify them.
and, you know, reenacting them while wearing these ridiculous, outlandish costumes and, you know, making an absurd film that is, you know, meant to accurately depict their history. And you just kind of, it's kind of like watching American Movie. It's kind of like watching, like, Springtime for Hitler. It's kind of like watching, it's theater of the absurd. I mean, Oppenheimer does take an active role in this movie, but he never makes the movie about him. He doesn't narrate it or anything like that. He just kind of presents these guys as they are. And there are little, side stories that take place. One of these guys is running for, I don't know what the word is. I'll just say president. And, you know, he's watching footage of President Obama and trying to act like President Obama. And when he actually goes out on the campaign trail, he's completely lost. He has no idea what to do. And you just kind of have to sit there and laugh. But overall, what people are going to think when they come out of this movie is devastation. There's one guy among many depicted here who you feel may not make it through this process before it finally dawns on him just how many lives lost he's responsible for. And I've seen this movie twice. Once I watched the online screener that was sent to me, and then I felt like I needed to watch it again in the theater without so many distractions around me. And I went to the Music Box tonight with a bunch of friends, and I can't remember the last time an audience sat and watched closing credits and just was dead silent. Nobody moved. Nobody could say anything, just watching these credits. By the way, there is not another movie out there that has this many credits where people are listed as anonymous.
Yeah.
There's so many springboards of discussion with this movie. I can't really do it justice. It is one of the best documentaries I've seen in a long, long time. Definitely, I think, the best movie out there right now. I can't recommend it highly enough, but it is a pretty devastating film while also being very, like, darkly, absurdly funny at the same time. Kind of blown away by it, especially the second time. Definitely highly recommend it.
Okay, The Act of Killing. When you get a quote from Werner Herzog on your poster and it says,
yeah,
I have not seen a film as powerful, surreal, and frightening in at least a decade, you've accomplished something.
Definitely. These are Herzog-type characters in this movie. I mean, it's like Grizzly Man all over again. It's like Grizzly Man times 10.
Man.
Like, just some of the things that just you watch take place in this movie, some of the things these guys say and you know, just how they try to justify being mass murderers, it's just frightening.
Wow.
It really is.
That sounds amazing. So, that sounds fascinating. Definitely got to get out there to see it. The Act of Killing, it's playing at the Music Box in Chicago. Okay, guys, hang on. We got more movies to review as the Midnight Movie Reviews continue. The Act of Killing, by the way, was the name of that film, playing at the Music Box. Sounds amazing. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Studios on the 7th floor of Trip Tower doing the Midnight Movie Reviews. Eric Childress, Colin Suter from eFilmCritic.com, and we welcome these guys back. Hi, guys.
Hello.
All right. Hello. Eric, why don't you tell us about Jobs?
Jobs. Okay. Well, this is the first of a couple planned biopics about Steve Jobs, the Apple founder, who recently passed away. Steve Jobs in the movie is played by Ashton Kutcher. As we sort of follow the path from back in the 70s when he was a college student, who sort of was first inspired by taking drugs and hanging out with his friends, and eventually came around to developing one of the first home personal computers, basically with the help of his friend Woz, played by Josh Gad. The film sort of follows his trajectory from the humble beginnings of Apple in his parents' garage, up into a full-fledged corporation, and his sort of ups and downs with the board of directors, represented by J.K. Simmons and Dermot Mulroney, and eventually Matthew Modine. This is a very loaded cast, and of what should be a very, very interesting story. Unfortunately, what we've been basically given here is sort of a lower-level television movie of the week version of his story. It's a film that sort of hits, you know, all the, you know, the basic beats of, you know, your general biopic, you know, the dates and events and the big names associated with those events, and you know big names like Macintosh and Pepsi and stuff like that, as we go through this career. But the movie never really has a real established point of view of who or what Steve Jobs is, or was, or is supposed to represent to us now, especially now that he's gone. Like a lot of biopics sort of get trapped into, you know, wanting to, expose the warts and all and whatnot, and basically show Steve Jobs as not maybe the nicest guy in the world, very much a taskmaster, very stubborn, very pigheaded at times. But, you know, that's basically where the sort of it ends for this movie. It, you know, it gets that part of it. But as far as him being sort of an inspirational visionary, basically all we're sort of left with in the film is Steve Jobs is a guy that would basically have an idea, and then a bunch of his friends would put the thing together, and then he would get all the credit for being the visionary. To me, that's not, you know, the kind of inspiration I want out of a film from Steve Jobs. And the film never really sort of establishes, you know, well, it keeps trying to prop him up as this guy that sort of changed the world and changed our lives forever, you know, basically just sort of made us, you know, a little more convenience happy with personal computers. Why is owning a personal computer, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know, for a lot of people? Why was that so important at a time when people, you know, may not have needed personal computers, and what that means to now? What does it mean to, you know, to have an iPod and have, you know, millions of songs in your pocket, you know, as the film sort of opens with, but never really quite gets back to? It's sort of oddly structured. The film feels like the last third of his life was sort of maybe left on the cutting room floor a little bit. This is a film that premiered at Sundance this year, but at the last minute canceled its press screenings. It was supposed to open in April, but then they postponed it back to August. This is not a very good film. Kutcher, you know, God bless him, he's trying really hard, but I think he spent a lot of time perfecting Steve Jobs' walk and forgot to do much else research on the man. Not recommending this film.
Colin.
Yeah, I don't entirely blame Kutcher's performance on himself. Part of it is the script, which doesn't give him much to do, or at least it doesn't allow him for much range. He basically, you know, he's either having a hissy fit, or he's trying to convince somebody to give him money, or, you know, he's you know, there just aren't that many sides to Steve Jobs in this movie that make it a compelling movie about somebody who was an interesting guy. I mean, the last third of this movie is basically a soap opera of CEOs, you know, changing hands, you know, Apple changing regimes and whatever. And yeah, this, I completely agree with Eric on this one. This is kind of your standard dry biopic. It pretty much does for Steve Jobs what 42 did for Jackie Robinson. You know, it's kind of a Cliff Notes version of, you know, what Steve Jobs' life, you know, was. Yeah, I don't recommend this film either. And it kind of drives me nuts because, I mean, I think the movie could have benefited from if they had focused on just like 1 year in Steve Jobs' life, you know, where he had to struggle really hard. Although they kind of did that with a TV movie called The Pirates of Silicon Valley,
right? Which
I thought was pretty good.
Which is a much better movie than this. Much better movie.
Yeah,
than this.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is. I mean, one of the things that drove me nuts that Eric touched upon was that, you know, we're supposed to, you know, in one scene, you know, we see Steve Jobs just berating an employee and treating him like garbage and, you know, firing him for, you know, just disagreeing with him. And then the next minute, the music swells, you know, the minute Steve Jobs produces a brand new computer and everybody's just applauds instantly without knowing, without being told what it does or what it's useful for. But the audience that's watching this movie is supposed to just feel like, wow, this was an amazing moment in American history. Good for Steve Jobs. But, you know, without really telling us anything, just like put the music on and let their hearts swell.
Yeah.
Very simplistic, not a very good film at all.
I agree with you guys 100%. I may have even liked it a little bit less than you guys did. I was pretty much bored out of my mind during this movie. And this is a film that should have been on television. It feels like a made for TV movie. Not even made for HBO. You know what I mean? Like it, you know.
Right. Yeah.
It just has that feel. And you know, it's not Kutcher's fault. I think he's in over his head playing a role that should be complicated like this. But there's not a whole lot he has to do. And I mean, I agree everything that you guys say. I echo 100%, except that neither of you mentioned how boring the movie is. So, so let me just add, it's also boring. That's what I'll say to it. So, I do not recommend Jobs. And I don't see a lot of people going out to see this thing. I just don't see this thing being a box office hit, despite the fact that everybody's talking about Ashton Kutcher's speech at the whatever the kids awards. Did you guys see that speech?
No.
I know people are talking about it, but I didn't see it.
It's pretty cool. You know, he does talk about how I find it ironic. I mean, it's, you know, he really gives a lot of positivity to the kids and he gives them really good message. And it's a very, you know, I think a really nice speech that that kids should listen to and, you know, and get some good advice from. But he talks about how, you know, people are trying to sell you a bunch of crap. And then, like, about 10 seconds later, he mentions the movie that he's in called Jobs. So that's the only issue that I have. I mean, I'm sure it was heartfelt and he really wanted to help these kids out, but he couldn't help but not get a plug in for his damn movie. So
about a guy that's trying to sell you stuff.
Exactly, man. Exactly. All right, guys, hang on. Colin and Eric are here, and we're going to review the movies. The last one there, Jobs, Ashton Kutcher, not worth seeing. News is coming up next, and we'll continue the movie reviews after that. Our Friday night show continues till 5 a.m. Always having a great time on Friday night. Our regular features, Drunks in the News, brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. Straight out of context, Nick D Show Spies all coming up. We are in the middle of the midnight movie reviews right now with Colin and Eric, and let's get back to that. Still got some movies to talk about, and let's go with Colin now. I believe you're all alone on this one.
Okay.
I believe that Eric and I have not seen the latest Lee Daniels masterpiece.
All right.
So The Butler is all yours, my man.
All right, here we go. Well, this is a movie loosely based on a memoir of a White House butler. And here it's a guy named Cecil, and he's played by Forrest Whitaker. And we follow him through six or seven decades worth of presidents. And he takes this type of job as a means of survival on a southern plantation and eventually works his way up to working in the White House under Eisenhower, played by, wait for it, Robin Williams. He has a wife played by Oprah Winfrey and a couple sons, one of which we see demonstrating at every civil rights rally he can and getting arrested numerous times in the process, something that doesn't sit well with the butler who would, you know, rather see his sons living on the straight and narrow. This guy doesn't want to, like, rock any boats or anything. So we basically follow this guy's story through about eight presidents, and the movie, you know, touches on all the major political events through the latter half of the 20th century, especially, you know, with regards to the civil rights movement. Apparently this guy's son was at every single meaningful political civil rights movement event that ever happened, because this movie covers them all, you know, in, you know, from a first person point of view. So you got Robin Williams as Eisenhower, you got James Marsden as John F. Kennedy, Alan Rickman as Ronald Reagan, Jane Fonda as Nancy Reagan, and perhaps most curious of all, John Cusack as Richard Nixon. I don't know why Lee Daniels is obsessed with miscasting John Cusack every chance he gets, but he's kind of being a serial miscaster at this point. In his career, it's kind of scary. The movie itself is, you know, not quite the train wreck I, you know, sort of imagined it would be. It sort of goes back and forth. Like, sometimes you know you're watching a Lee Daniels movie, and then sometimes you think, wow, he actually did a good job of directing this scene. It's not ham-fisted. It's not labored. It's actually kind of moving in a way. And then the next scene, it's like, oh, here we go. Here's a Lee Daniels movie. He's laying it on thick and, you know, pressing all the buttons that he likes to press. Some of the performances are pretty absurd, like Cusack as Richard Nixon. But then, you know, there, what I do admire about a lot of the acting and a lot of the actors in this movie is the ones who are playing, you know, Eisenhower and Reagan and JFK, they're not trying to do like a perfect impression of these guys. You know, I've seen Kennedy portrayed, you know, with a really thick Boston accent, and, you know, some actors go way over the top with it. And I thought Marsden did a really good job not trying too hard to emulate, you know, not presenting him as a caricature. Same with Alan Rickman and Jane Fonda as the Reagans. They didn't try too hard, you know, by getting the voice and coming off looking ridiculous. They actually downplayed it, a little more subdued. And I appreciated that. I like that about this movie. But basically, this is, you know, it's been compared to Forrest Gump, and, you know, understandably so, just, you know, with how much time is covered, and, you know, every time they transition, much like the movie Jobs, every time they transition to, you know, a new era, it's accompanied by, you know, a song that was popular on an FM station at the time, a really, you know, a cliched song that we've heard 1,000 times. So it's a very, it's an incredibly, again, it's like Jobs, very simplistic, doesn't have a lot to say. You know, I don't look at Forrest Gump as a great history lesson either, but there it's playing with a lot of themes that are very deep and very personal. Whereas this movie doesn't really, it's just, you come out of this movie and thinking, wow, this butler met a lot of presidents. That's pretty cool. And that's it, you know? So it's got a few strengths, mostly with some of the performances. Some of the scenes are really well done, but on the whole, it's a very simplistic and not very interesting film.
Okay. All right. So that's, Lee Daniels, The Butler.
Yeah.
And let's move on. Eric, now you are all alone here, and you can handle Paranoia. Tell us about Paranoia.
Okay. Well, Paranoia, this is the latest film from director Robert Luketic. And if you, people who want to IMDb his name, go right ahead and do that. The film stars Liam Hemsworth as a guy that works at sort of a phone tech company. As part of a team, not necessarily sort of, they look like paid interns. At least they're given grants and stuff from the company to develop new products. And the owner of this particular company is played by Gary Oldman. And when Hemsworth basically fails at his big presentation and insults the head of the company. He and his team is let go, and he takes them out on a spending spree of the company credit card that apparently is still active. And so the next morning, Gary Oldman and his ruthless minions come looking for Liam Hemsworth to get back his money in any way they can, and basically enlist him into a corporate espionage scheme involving Oldman's old partner, and mentor, in a way, played by Harrison Ford, who owns a rival phone company.
Now, at any point in the movie, does Harrison Ford tell Gary Oldman to get off his plane?
He doesn't, but there is a moment in the film where he could have the opportunity to say, get out of my club.
Okay.
and I was waiting for it, and I actually said it out loud in the theater.
Yeah, of course you did.
but I think it's that moment we're all waiting for. And so Hemsworth is put together by Oldman's minions, played by M. Beth Devitt and Julian McMahon, in a hilarious, over-the-top performance as his henchman. Who knew that, like, you know, like AT&T and, you know, Verizon have, like, guys with guns? you know, scaring people. But anyway, so Hemsworth ends up getting a job at Harrison Ford's company in the hopes of uncovering the specs of his latest phone gizmo that Gary Oldman wants for his company. And it becomes this sort of this not-so-labyrinth, you know, back and forth, where Hemsworth's character is now sort of enjoying the good life, a la Wall Street. This the plot sort of borrows very liberally from, and is then basically put into a situation where he's, supposedly Gene Hackman in The Conversation, or at least Gene Hackman, an enemy of the state. And is hence where the title comes from, is he's sort of monitored by all this phone technology and spy technology that's put throughout his apartment and his life and whatnot. Nikki, earlier this evening you called Passion the laziest film you've seen this year.
Yeah.
Go see the other P, one-word P title, and you will see how wrong that statement is.
Yeah.
Because this is one of the laziest films to come out of Hollywood in some time. Robert Luketak is one of the worst directors working today. This is the guy that is responsible for 21, Legally Blonde, The Killers.
Ugly Truth.
This might be the worst of the bunch. Maybe not the most offensive of the bunch, just offensive in just how absolutely lazy it is in storytelling. I mean, the paranoia of the title barely exists in the movie. To even bring up films like Conversation, Wall Street, even Enemy of the State, is pretty insulting.
Yeah.
Compared to what is delivered in this film. Harrison Ford and Gary Oldman, they get a couple of scenes together and are not, clearly not afraid to go completely over the top in those scenes. Those are the only scenes that have any sort of bit of life to them whatsoever, even though they're really kind of ridiculously set up and performed. Liam Hemsworth is a non-factor. Amber Heard is the love interest, not even interesting. This is the kind of film because Richard Dreyfuss plays Liam Hemsworth's father in the movie, and put together that gene pool, if you will, for a moment.
Yeah.
This is the kind of movie I was hoping that like Steven Spielberg would watch this movie and immediately call Harrison and Dreyfuss for a job afterwards. this is one of the absolute worst films of the year, and it's barely even good in a laughable sort of way. It's just you sit there and you watch all the choices made by these characters. There's not a redeemable character in the movie. The twists are non-existent. The climax is ridiculous. It has one of the worst heist sequences I've ever seen in a movie. I don't know. This is the guy that should be stopped, Robert Luketak. Films like this, I don't even know how they get made, honestly, because this is absolutely horrendous.
I'm looking at the poster. It's already got a DVD poster. Like, you look at the poster, it's like, this thing has got to go straight to cable, right? I mean,
yeah. So. This film doesn't live up to the promise of antitrust, for God's sake.
Oh, man.
Okay? Antitrust is like a star and a half better movie than this is.
Way to pull that one out, man.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Okay, well, there you go. Paranoia, not good. Let us take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got more movies to talk about. Nick DiGilio here on The Voice of Chicago, 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Studios on the 7th floor of the Trib Tower. Trunks in the News, brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn, is coming up, as well as our other regular features, Nick D Show Spies and Straight Outta Context. After 2 o'clock, we will be talking with our friend and PR guru, Richard Larmer, who always has a lot of interesting things to say about the world of showbiz and pop culture. And we've got a ton of other stuff to keep you entertained throughout the night, all the way until 5 a.m. The phone number is 312-981-7200. You can send your texts to 24720, and we'll be reading those texts as well all night long. And you can hook up with us. The best way to stay hooked up is facebook.com/Nick D Show. Colin Suter and Eric Childress are back. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
All right. Now, you two dudes can handle the next one, which is the new Lake Bell movie that she's not only in but wrote and directed, and it's called In a World. And I know that Eric, you covered this one for us at one of those film festivals.
Sundance, yeah.
Okay, I always forget which one it is.
So
let's start with Colin. Why don't you tell us about this one?
Okay, so Lake Bell plays a woman who's, well, her father is one of the current kings of movie trailer voiceovers. And a bit of an egomaniac, and he's about to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Golden Trailers. His daughter, played by Lake Bell, is also an aspiring, she is a voice actor who likes to, her job right now is to sort of overdub actresses who can't do convincing accents. And she likes to record random people talking, random people's accents without them knowing so she can, better learn them. She sees that, recording voiceovers for trailers is kind of a man's world. And when you think about it, she's right. We don't often hear women doing voiceovers on trailers. She moves out of her father's house and moves in with her sister and her husband, played by Michaela Watkins and Rob Corddry. She's still trying to forge some kind of voice career, that she can call her own. And in the process, she's, winning the affections of a studio engineer, played by Dimitri Martin. All sorts of drama ensues, when a studio putting together a trailer for like a Hunger Games type movie. They're looking for voiceover talent, and it could go to her dad. It could go to his, protege that he has, or it can go in another direction entirely. So this is, a movie about a job that, hasn't been depicted in movies as far as I know, that of, the voiceover trailer person. Featuring a dynamic that I also haven't seen too often in movies between a father and daughter as sort of working rivals. I think this is not a great film. It's a charming film. It's got a lot of great. I think Lake Bell is a charming enough presence, and I think she carries the movie very well. There are some unexpected moments, towards the end that I found really refreshing, a couple of nice little twists that, just sort of twists on a convention, not really like out of nowhere plot twists, but just things that I found really, refreshingly different about this movie. I'm sort of a sucker for movies about jobs that are unusual or, stressful or, just that kind of opened my eyes to a world that I've, haven't really seen before. In the workplace. I like this movie. It didn't get under my skin, didn't make me laugh out loud that much, but I enjoyed the fact that there's a movie out there about voiceover, for movie trailers, and that it's actually kind of a cutthroat industry of its own. I do recommend this movie.
Okay. All right, Eric, I remember you're not too crazy about this film, right?
Yeah, I didn't find this film great, good, or charming, actually. I thought this film was a real sort of missed opportunity to sort of be the kind of film that Colin really kind of wanted out of this thing, is this idea of, women, a specialty job that, doesn't really specializes in women. That's a real pointed topic. Lake Bell is just not the person to tell the story. For one, Lake Bell possesses, about all the comedic talents that, make us want to forgive Malin Ackerman in most of her career. As a sort of a writer and director, I think she's really she sort of contradicts her own point throughout a lot of the movie, especially when the movie in the second act basically kind of takes a turn and becomes, basically you're sort of the kind of generic romantic comedy that is sort of made fun of in the film. And by the time the film sort of gets around to its sort of ultimate, sort of ironic point in the end, you kind of wish the film was a lot more, focused on that and was, not spending so much time, dealing with side relationships and this father-daughter dynamic that I think is more off-putting than sort of interesting and sort of exploring, the idea of them as rivals. It's very over-the-top and unconvincing, and it's...
I think we lost Eric.
Oh, yeah, what is that?
I don't know what's going on. Let's put Eric on hold. I don't know. Can we see what's going on with Eric? His phone exploded. Is he all right?
I thought that was me.
Did Gary Oldman? Did Gary Oldman get to him? What happened? So Eric, by the way, did not enjoy. It sounds like
no,
did not enjoy.
It was not a ringing endorsement.
In a world, and I'm actually a fan of Lake Bell. I don't, you know, I've liked her in movies.
Yeah,
I also think she's very attractive.
Yeah, well, that goes a long way too. Yeah.
What was it? She was in. I'm trying to remember. She was in.
Hold on, I got her IMDb page.
I've seen her in a bunch. Well, we've all seen her in a bunch of stuff. So I don't know what happened.
Right.
We're having a hard time getting a hold of Eric. So we'll you know what we're going to do? We're going to take a break. We got the news coming up anyway, and we'll try to get a hold of Eric as we continue. So Colin, hang on.
Okay.
All right, Colin's going to hang on. We'll get back with Eric here and find out what happened. But first, we're going to take a quick break. We got the news. We'll finish up the quick review of In a World, and then we will jump into our review of Kick-Ass 2. That's coming up, and then we got Drunks in the News and Straight Outta Context and all that stuff coming up as well. We are live in the Allstate studio on the 7th floor of the Tribune Tower here overlooking Michigan Avenue. Finishing up the midnight movie reviews, we got one more movie to review here. And then we'll move on to Drunks in the News and Straight Out of Context and Nick D Show Spies, and I'll explain to you guys on how you can participate in all of those. And we welcome Colin and Eric back. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
All right, Eric, tell us about Kick-Ass 2.
Okay. Kick-Ass 2, this is the sequel to the 2010 sort of faux superhero film that dealt with the idea that, you know, what if ordinary people in the real world dressed up as superheroes and didn't necessarily have any actual powers. The breakout star of that film was Hit Girl, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, who was more of a supporting character the first time around. This time she has sort of a co-lead status. A few years have passed since the events of the previous film. At least some time has. I don't remember exactly how many years, but Hit Girl is a little bit older. Even though she's enrolled in high school, she's not exactly staying for her courses. She gets dropped off by her guardian, Morris Chestnut, and then takes off to sort of continue her training as Hit Girl. And she is joined by the guy known as Kick-Ass, played by Aaron Johnson, who is looking to sort of expand his role as Kick-Ass, as the sort of the guardian of the streets, and wants to sort of, you know, have the sort of the training that Hit Girl was put through from her late father, who was played by Nicolas Cage in the first film. As the film goes on, the two sort of begin to take different paths. Kick-Ass's character, while building up his own strengths, sort of hooks up with some new sort of faux superheroes on the streets, masked vigilantes that he has sort of inspired to take up the cause of injustice that has plagued the streets. One of them, a new leader played by Jim Carrey, known as Captain Stars and Stripes, who is sort of the leader of this this underground gang that has a number of other people. And while Hit Girl's becomes her activities are a little more found out, she vows to behave a little bit more like a normal 16-year-old girl, and that involves her getting involved with some cliques in school. One particular clique that's very reminiscent of Mean Girls. She discovers that, you know, villains can exist. You know, they don't necessarily have to have costumes on the streets to be sort of inflicting pain and justice out there. And all the while, the surviving bad guy of the original, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, who was the son of the big boss crime overlord that was defeated in the first film, he is now seeking revenge for his father's death against Kick-Ass, and is branding himself as a name that we cannot say on the air. He is rounding up his own gang of masked villains and henchmen to take out Kick-Ass once and for all and claim the evil streets that his father once did. The original Kick-Ass to me was very much a mixed bag. It was a film that was sort of contradictory in its message about not only the idea of the mass superheroes, but just how far one can go to extend the idea of violence in a violent world. The highlight of that film obviously was the dynamic between Nicolas Cage and Chloe Grace Moretz. Their stuff in the film, very memorable, while the exploits of Aaron Johnson's Kick-Ass were just very bland, downright boring at times, and really was sort of the biggest problem, a stupid character in a film that should have been about something more. This film, surprisingly enough, plays with a few more ideas, where the original Kick-Ass was all about sort of the what-ifs and whatnot, and featured plenty of violence and vulgarity to boot. This film, I think explores the idea more of, how far do you extend violence in a violent world, and not having consequences for that. And this is a film where all the sort of the people who begin the violence are the ones who are sort of punished in the movie, both good and bad. And I found that really kind of refreshing. I think that the stuff, some of the best stuff in the film involves, again, Hit Girl, not when she's being Hit Girl, but when she is sort of, taking on the sort of her sort of Clark Kent-like role in high school and discovering, not only what it's like to be a high school girl these days and, all the changes that she's going through, but, what it's like to sort of, suppress that power and to not, be the one who's going to necessarily kill people in high school, which is, sort of the very thing that Jim Carrey is not, the very reason Jim Carrey is not promoting this film, this ideas that he has that this film is too violent to be promoted, even though he plays a character in the film that is very much against guns. I found those ideas refreshing, even though not all of them are paid off quite as well, even the very one I mentioned. But I actually like this movie more than the original, surprisingly enough. I think the film is very funny in spots. I think Christopher Mintz-Plasse is having a blast. His sort of faux role as this villain that's not quite sure exactly what he's doing or what role he's trying to solve. The fact that Kick-Ass's character is sort of reduced in many ways to somewhat of a supporting role in many spots, I think, is a big improvement, while obviously bulking up Hit Girl's role. It's certainly not a great film by any stretch. I give it sort of a passing recommendation, though it seems a lot of the colleagues are going the opposite way, especially since apparently they like the original film a lot more than I did. So I'm giving a passing recommendation, but a recommendation nevertheless.
Okay, Colin?
Yeah, I'm with Eric 100% on this one. It's a funnier film. It's a faster-paced movie. It's a more interesting movie because for the same reason Eric says, the character of Kick-Ass is minimized a little bit, which is good. Visually, there's some really funny visual gags in this film, especially all the stuff dealing with Christopher Mintz-Plasse is one of the funniest superhero, or I'm sorry, villain, costume get-ups I've ever seen. And his lair, where everybody gathers around, is some pretty funny stuff going on in there, too. It's just a better movie all around. It's more exciting. It's a little more, it's more interesting. A lot more Chloe Grace Moretz in this film, which I mean, I'm glad she's in front and center of the movie because, she's turning out to be one of our best young actresses. And it's just great when she shows up in something. I'm kind of giving this the same sort of passing recommendation too. It's not great. It's interesting. I mean, it's weird for me to hear Eric talk about this movie's ideas about violence on the same night I saw The Act of Killing again. So it's interesting. These two movies are coming out the same weekend. But if you're looking for a great action comedy, with a lot of violence and a little vulgarity, this is pretty good. But we got a better one next weekend, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I'm recommending this one.
I like the first one better. I thought this one was okay. I think the addition, you know, pumping up Chloe Grace Moretz. Listen, anytime you get more Chloe Grace Moretz, it's good. I don't care in what capacity. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
She's awesome. But I like the first one more. Is that the majority of people? Majority of people like the first one more?
Yeah, but I think there are reasons that they're pumping up the original that I think are a little off base and compared to the criticisms that they have of this film. I mean, a lot of the criticism I'm hearing about this film is that this film is just all vulgarity and none of the wit. And, you know, meanwhile, I'll hear what you have to say about it.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, I kind of agree with that. I'm not going to, you know, rip this movie apart for being too vulgar or too violent or anything like that. I mean, the first one was rated R and had a lot of violence in it. For me, I wasn't offended by it. I didn't think it was too violent. I didn't think it was too vulgar. I'm not quite sure why Jim Carrey is taking the stand that he's taking on this movie. That I just don't quite understand. I don't think it's, you know, I think, like, the first Kick-Ass I thought was okay. I thought it was fine. I liked it. I thought it was good. This one, it's fine. It's good. It's just not as much. I don't think it's as well made a film as the first one. I think it's very comparable to the first one, though. The thing to me that I loved about the first one, I mean, there were a lot of things I liked about the first one, but the thing that I really loved was the dynamic between Chloe Grace Moretz and Nicolas Cage, which you mentioned, Eric. And that, having that missing from this movie, I don't know, those were the best scenes in the original Kick-Ass, and that having that being missed from this film, I think, really takes a chunk out of it. For me, both of the films, Kick-Ass 2 and Kick-Ass, they're fine. They're okay. I like the first one more than the second one, but I don't dislike this movie. And it's like a 2.5-er for me. So I understand that you guys, I you know, because of my insane schedule this week, I missed a very massive screening this morning that I couldn't go to, that I had to sleep through. But we were going to talk about that next week.
So yes, we are.
So, by the way, for those of you who don't know, the third in the Cornetto trilogy, and also it can also be the We Can't Really Quite Climb Over a Fence trilogy.
Yes,
because that gags in all three of them as well. But anyway, The World's End comes out next week, one of the most highly anticipated films for me of the year, without question. And I know that Colin and Eric feel the same way. They screened it this morning. These guys saw it, and I had to sleep because I've been working overnight all week. I'm either going to go Thursday night to see it, depending on how my schedule works out, but I will definitely be seeing it tomorrow. Friday next week when we review the movie, and I might be fresh from the screening, so I might be jumping up and down like a monkey next week when we review this movie.
Yeah, I don't think Your Next is going to be the only film you're referring to about year-end stuff.
Yeah, well, Your Next comes out next week. Let me tell you something. You're a horror film fan. This movie kicks all kinds of ass. That's all I'm saying. I absolutely loved Your Next, and it was such a fun, you know, you guys can imagine, midnight show at Flashback, packed theater. You know,
that's the right audience.
Yeah. And
absolutely the right audience.
And a cash bar at the right at the bottom of the thing. It was an absolute blast. So anyway, those two we got next week. What else we got?
Well, those are the two big ones. Drinking Buddies is going to be opening in theaters next week.
Oh, right. Okay. All right.
Have you seen that yet? Nick?
I have not yet. No.
You catch up with that for next week.
Yeah, that's great.
That'll be good to talk about.
That's great. I spent $10 on Passion. I appreciate that. That was fantastic.
You absolutely.
Yeah.
We'll try and get that back.
Yeah, exactly. Doing? I'm still working on the Canyons, trying to get that one back.
Yeah, exactly. Canyons, that, and Daisies, something. I don't know. Send it on off your bill. Get that off.
All right.
Austin Land opens next week as well. Yeah. Oh, and Mortal Instruments City of Bones.
Oh, God. All right.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll talk to you guys next week, okay?
Okay.
Colin and Eric, always a pleasure. We'll talk to these guys next week, and we'll do the midnight movie reviews all over again. Quick break. We come back. It's time for Drunks in the News, brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. That's right. It's that time of the week. This is the time of the week when we take the stupid drunk stories of stupid drunk people doing stupid drunk stuff when they're stupid and drunk. We read them all together, and we call it Drunks in the News. Drunks in the News. And Drunks in the News is brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn in Jefferson Park. You know, I can't say enough about the Gale Street Inn. I love the place. George, my main man who runs the place, all the great staff. Every time you go there, you feel like your family. You have great food. It's a great time. It's the best restaurant ever. If you're hungry, you want to have a special occasion, go to the Gale Street Inn in Jefferson Park on Milwaukee Avenue. Just the best restaurant ever. And I want to thank George and everybody at the Gale Street Inn for sponsoring Drunks in the News and being so awesome. So let's get this thing going. And by the way, if you want to be a part of Drunks in the News, like Chuck in Naperville, you want to read a drunk story on the air, here's what you do. Find the link to a funny drunk story online. Say, hey, I'd like to read that. Send the link and a note to Craig, my producer, at ccollins@wgnradio.com. That's C-C-O-L-L-I-N-S, ccollins@wgnradio.com. Say, hey, Craig, I'd like to read this on the air. He'll get back to you, and you'll read it on the air. And not only that, you'll get a $50 gift card to the Gale Street Inn. So it's a win-win-win situation. You get to be a part of Drunks in the News, and you get yourself a Gale Street Inn gift card. Once again, send your link to a funny drunk story and your request to read it on the air to ccollins@wgnradio.com. Here we go. Drunk number one. Drunk number one.
I come home on Friday.
A motorist drove his car over a 40-foot cliff, was able to walk away from the accident without serious injuries. The suspected drunk driver refused to allow paramedics to treat him at the scene of a crash in San Diego. The man, who has not been named, drove his sedan over the steep bluff in the early hours yesterday morning. To reach the shoreline, he'd already smashed through a locked gate at high speed. The man got out of his car, started wandering around the beach and into the water, ignoring bystanders on the cliff above. His car landed the correct way up and was relatively undamaged, although the back end appeared to have been damaged in the fall. When witnesses called 911, firefighters, paramedics, and lifeguards arrived onto the scene, some swimming to the cove and others being lowered by a hoist. However, the man initially refused treatment despite his injuries. One paramedic told the UT San Diego he was fighting, screaming, and yelling. Eventually, rescue workers managed to calm him down, and the man was airlifted to the UC San Diego Medical Center, was being treated for non-life-threatening injuries. He was suspected of having been under the influence of alcohol at the time of the accident. The car remained on the beach for several hours before being lapped by the waves until it was finally removed by a tow truck. Drunk number two, drunk number two.
I said, but I'm tired.
We've all been there, too inebriated to find our bed. Well, one man in China took his big night a little too far. He ended up locked inside a shipping container about to depart on a two-week journey to Los Angeles. After a night of apparently heavy drinking, Zhang Wu confused the 60-foot shipping container at a port for the bed and breakfast he was staying in eastern China. When he woke up the next day, he found that he was stuck inside a sealed shipping container, one that was scheduled for departure in an hour. Luckily, Wu had cell phone reception on his side and called everyone he knew for help, quote-unquote, as well as the police. But there existed an even larger problem. Of the thousands of stacked containers around him, Wu had no clue which container he was housed in. Police eventually were able to locate and free him by making banging sounds inside the container, which were stacked 60 feet high in the air. How do you do that?
Now you for that too.
Drunk number three. Drunk number three.
I'll tell the landlady.
Drunk number three is our friend Chuck in Naperville. Drunk number three. Here's Chuck in Naperville.
Hi, this is Chuck from Naperville, and I'm recording for Drunks in the News. A drunk man was arrested after he allegedly was caught masturbating after smashing his way into a fire station. Nicholas Gonzalez was detained by officers after breaking into the Metro Firehouse in Louisville, Kentucky, in the early hours of Saturday morning. It is alleged he smashed a bay window of the fire station and removed the fireman's gear from lockers. When firefighters at the station went to investigate the sound of smashing glass, they allegedly found Mr. Gonzalez, 27, pleasuring himself in front of the equipment. Firefighter Michael Davenport told WHAS-TV that Mr. Gonzalez never acknowledged him when he caught him. He said he continued his lewd act, and that's when I grabbed him by his shirt and dragged him out. Police were called, and Mr. Gonzalez was arrested. Officers reportedly said he was under the influence of alcohol at the time. He has since been charged with burglary in the second degree, public intoxication, and criminal mischief. This has been Chuck from Naperville for Drunks in the News.
All right. We had a similar one, very, very similar one to that like last month. Okay, we got to go out vote here. We got three here. We got the Chinese guy who fell asleep in a shipping container about to leave for L.A. We got the guy who busted into the firehouse and did some lewd stuff. And we got the drunk man who survived driving off a cliff. And Craig.
I mean, I got to know how bad the bed and breakfast in China is that you could confuse them, but I got to vote for that.
Okay. And is George around?
He should be.
Oh, I'm here.
All right. What are you voting for?
Going with the bed and breakfast.
Yeah, me too. All right. So the shipping container is the winner. No question. No question about it. Same bat time, same bat channel next week for Drugs in the News. Drugs in the News. Brought to you by the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. And we've got Straight Out of Context. You know what this is. You listen to this radio station 24/7 whenever anybody says anything that you can pull out of context, a couple of seconds here, a couple of seconds there, and it sounds dirty. Jot down the day, the time, who said it, and send it to ccollins@wgnradio.com. Go ahead.
We have seven this week. The first one comes from Larry B., and it is Gary Meyer.
Get started with this monkey.
The next one is from Dirty Dave, and it's Johnny B.
You're sitting there with this giant organ.
From Wild Bill, Johnny B.
Dropped a tool down his throat.
Okay.
From Lisa in Kenosha, this is Mr. Movie Phone on with Johnny B.
There was more wood at that table than I've seen in my whole life.
All right.
Yeah, obviously, Johnny got the joke. This is from Kristen Decker, who likes sending them to us now, and it's Dean Richards.
I was knee-deep in Kenny G and Yanni.
Okay, next.
From Larry B., it's Leslie Kiling during Gary's show.
We've got word of somebody losing a load of wood.
Okay.
From Kevin in Iowa, this is you, Nick.
That doesn't look like something that I would like to stick into my mouth. Okay.
There you go.
All right. Now, you know, spies, if you want to be a Nick D show spy, that's what this is. You listen 24/7, and whenever I am mentioned on any other show or the show is mentioned in any capacity, jot down the day, the time, who said it, and again, send it to ccollins@wgnradio.com. What do we got?
The first one's a quicker one. This is from Diane in Naperville, and it's Gary Meyer.
I just never liked that genre of movies. I know Nick the Digital.
The Digital.
Which I've renamed him. He's on this radio station. He loves that kind of stuff.
Not even like Rosemary's Baby?
I did see that.
That's a good one. That's not overly scary.
No, but I think that was the last real scary one that I saw. And that one set my mind to Twitter, and I didn't want to go back.
There you go.
All right. And the next spy.
This is a little bit of a longer one. It's also from Diane in Naperville, and it's Steve Cochran today playing back a conversation you had with Orion Samuelson.
And now, I've not been to Big Al's. I was surprised to find out that you had, but there's a story. Do we have the clip? Roll the clip.
But is that, you know, being someone who's never been there, is that just a total
I've never been
nudie
there.
Bar? Or is that...
I don't know. I've okay. never been there.
Orion?
Yes, I no. was there once early in my career when we were doing a Farm Progress show
for
near
work.
Peoria.
Yeah.
And the band Lino Frigo and the musical Wheel said, oh, there's a place we have to go, and it's great food. And so I think they're taking me to a restaurant because I had not heard about Big Al's. And then we go down the stairs, and no, this is not a restaurant.
One more time, the name of the band?
Lino Frigo and the musical Wheels traveled with me for years on the noon show circuit.
And they brought Orion to
point.
Big Al's.
Yeah, because I was this new kid on the block at WGN from a dairy farm in Wisconsin. Hey, I'll bet he's never seen something like this. And
wow.
then they tell me it was a great restaurant.
How long has...
Good eggs and hash browns.
Yeah. How long has Big Al's been around?
Well, I think my visit there was in 64 or 65, so and it was an institution by then. So,
well, Big Al's got to be dead then, right, Big O? I mean, isn't Big Al gone to the strip club in the sky?
Apparently not, but then we began to learn more from other people who had been there for the reason to go there, not because it's a fine restaurant. And
or for Lino Frigo and the musical,
and the musical
Wheels.
Wheel.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we heard it was named after Al Capone, who would make visits to Peoria.
There you go. Well, he's dead. We know that.
Yeah, we know that. So I don't know if there ever was or still is a Big Al. I don't know.
But we do know Big Al's does exist, and apparently,
still there.
According to one caller, there was a rehab going on, and it was being moved to a nicer location.
There you go. Yeah, that was yesterday morning with Orion Samuelson. It was fantastic. Orion, in fact, has been to Big Al's strip club in Peoria. All right, if you want to be a Nick D show spy, once again, listen 24/7, and whenever I am mentioned or the show is mentioned in any capacity, jot down the day, the time, who said it, and send it to ccollins@wgnradio.com.